Management teams just obsess and spend so much time, typically in public companies. How do we grow 2%, 3%, 3.5%? And yet it may, I stress, may be the case that actually shrinking by 3% or 5% could be the biggest EBITDA and free cash flow opportunity in the company. And properly communicated, I stress that, properly communicated and telegraphed to public markets, we have seen and believe profoundly that that is value creating.
From McKinsey & Company, I'm Sean Brown, and welcome to Inside the Strategy Room. That was John Kelleher, one of our guests today, for a discussion on insights from private equity for public company leaders. John's a senior partner in our private equity special operations group. He serves as an interim in-house executive, helping clients execute large PE-style transformations. John's also served in multiple executive roles in the private equity industry, including as CEO. John, welcome.
Good day, Sean. It's great to be here.
Also joining us is Radhika Ray, a partner in our private equity group with more than 15 years of experience in private equity. She serves clients on large-scale transformations and oversees our service line that implements rapid labor productivity improvements. Radhika, welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Terrific. So I'm sure our listeners know that private equity has experienced enormous growth over the last few decades. But John, why don't you give us a sense of what's been behind that growth?
So listen, let me set the stage a little bit. And I'd like to sort of take you back to the year 2000, when total assets under management in the private equity world was sub $1 trillion, somewhere around $700 billion. In 2021, that number was $7 trillion. And under our latest set of forecasts, we predict by 2030, the industry is actually going to triple in size to something around $20 trillion. And so the growth and impact of this industry globally is very stunning. And I think on top of that, I would add that the returns from the industry, which have exceeded the returns of comparable public assets, are also very impressive. There's a lot of compelling research showing that private equity owned assets sell at higher multiples, produce higher productivity, higher profitability, better commercial results, et cetera. So we would argue there's something to be learned here. And I think in a nutshell, that's hopefully going to be some of the insights that we're sharing this morning.
Indeed. And we're looking forward to discussing some of those lessons from PE today. But before we start, maybe we can first discuss why non-PE leaders should be looking to private equity for how to navigate the current economic environment.
I'm going to argue that we are easily living in the most complex macro environment that we've seen in around 40 years. So in almost every jurisdiction on the planet, we've had record inflation. Certainly the incredible spike in inflation caused central banks around the world, not just the US Fed, to aggressively hike rates. Call it 200 to 400 basis points in every, you know, in many large jurisdictions around the world. That's 28 of about 34 major central banks have been raising rates. We've had very low consumer and CEO sentiment, really mixed consumer spending signals, a ton of supply chain challenges, white hot labor markets and imbalances persisting around the world, high commodity prices off their peaks, but still elevated. And then as if all of that wasn't enough, we've got some major geopolitical conflict and tension happening around the world. So pair that with an incredibly fast-moving business environment, which is arguably the fastest moving we've ever seen, right? So most complex macro environment in 40 years, plus this fastest moving business environment ever. And what we say is, you know, the bar is incredibly high on execution. And I think private equity firms are real leaders in recognizing that that environment requires strong and bold and fast responses.
Thank you for that context, John. I'm looking forward to talking with you and Radhika about the seven lessons for company leaders that you'll share from your experience working in private equity. And so let's dive in on the first, the importance of effective financial planning and analysis, or FP&A.
So I think my message would be, you know, in the world of private equity, I think PE firms are
excellent at realizing that if you can't see the world around you and if you don't have good gauges on where your financials are trending, you're beat before you start. Because if your FP&A and dashboards are weak, then everything else doesn't matter because you're way behind the eight ball. So what is world-class FP&A? Well, something I'd like to highlight is Radhika and I spend a lot of time with public company CFOs and public company FP&A teams. And we pretty consistently see these as weaknesses that could be strengthened much more in the line of what PE companies do. So let me rapid fire through these. Macro assumptions are parameterized and from a third party. You won't believe how many times we see FP&A forecasts. We ask, where are the inflation assumptions coming from? Where are the GDP assumptions coming from? Often they're kind of manufactured. They're not from a clearly identifiable third party. And even they're inconsistent across BUs and departments. So the first thing is kind of getting that clear, getting that right. Second thing, a P level. That means, what probability have you attached to the cash flow forecasts, right? That's one of my favorite questions to ask CFOs. Amazing how many have FP&A dashboards or outputs, but there's no clear probability level around it. Next, inflation assumptions are different by revenue line item and by cost item. We see a lot of forecasts with one inflation assumption, right? Cloud subscription costs are inflating double digits. Some revenue categories are shrinking in terms of their inflation numbers. So you have to go granular. A momentum case modeled, meaning what happens to revenue, gross margin, EBITDA, free cash, absent any management initiatives. You have to have bedrock to build management incentives upon. A true downside case is modeled. Amazing how many times that really weak downside cases are modeled or no downside case. So we're big proponents of that. And then finally, back testing, right? I can't stress this enough, the importance of back testing. That is making sure the model is improving every week and its predictive power is improving every week and you're monitoring those error values.
Great. So you mentioned both the importance of FP&A as well as dashboards. What makes for an effective dashboard?
So the first concept is cascading dashboards. It's very important that reports start at the underwriting model in the world of private equity. And in the world of a public company, that might be sort of the approved long-term plan. And then cascade into a five-year plan that cascades into an AOP, an annual operating plan, cascades into quarterly, monthly, weekly, daily flash. Private equity firms are very good at getting this sort of cascading set of reports working and making sure that the reports we're using to monitor the business are the same ones we're using to report on the business and present to the board. So there's one set of standardized reports that gets used throughout the business. This is much less common in public assets, and we think a real opportunity. And lastly, I just want to talk about causal flow of dashboards. So I think the way to think about dashboards is first we operate safely and in compliance with laws and regulations, right? Including ESG. Then we build quality outputs. Then we do it quickly. Then we make sure that there's high customer satisfaction. And lastly, we do it at low cost, right? There's a causality to how we train managers to produce the right outputs. And if you do all of those things well, you produce really good integrated economics, cash flow, income statement, balance sheet, credit statistics, right? So we love to see that causality in dashboards.
Sure. Thank you, John. Are there any challenges for public company leaders that want to implement this FP&A approach that maybe private equity doesn't really have with their portfolio companies?
Yeah, look, I think it's a great question. Doing what we're talking about here is a bit of a one-time reset, right? So I would never say that, you know, this doesn't take a real investment of time to get it right. I think private equity firms are really good when they initially enter an asset, they take the time to do this properly and they spend real money, real time to set it up properly and nothing else will do. So I think the answer, Sean, is you've got to get your head around, it is going to be a go slow to go fast kind of an idea. and you might have to take 3 months to put this in place.
Got it. So Radhika, the next insight is around clean sheeting. Maybe you could start by defining what you mean by that term and then how one puts it into practice.
So this is an approach about rapid labor productivity increase. So it's the premise that smaller and highly talented teams actually perform better. And in private equity, even more than cost reduction, this was about creating a faster moving business with accountability way up and better outcomes across the board, even things like customer satisfaction. So it's really about rethinking what every single department does. And the first thing we do is look at ratios that firms don't normally look at, such as revenue for total wage dollars or revenue per FTE. And you can set targets based on this. And the targets must be transformational. You know, if you typically set incremental targets, a couple of percent a year, just reduce your headcount, you can do that without actually rethinking what is done and how it's done. So we say set transformational targets, and that really forces leaders to rethink how the actual work is done. And there are four simple steps that we use to do this. The first is, you know, killing low value add work. We're very ruthless about that because, you know, it just creates time and everyone appreciates that. You know, one example I like giving is there was a company that spent 11 months on their annual budgeting process. And we collapsed that to 3 months, and those employees were able to do something else much more useful with their time. The second step we take is centralizing the groups. We think distributed teams lead to slack. It's very hard to have 10 good teams all doing something similar and 10 great leaders. So find the best leader and put everyone under that one group. You know, one example here is there was a company that had 600 analysts spread across the company doing very good analytics work. And we moved it under one leader who is amazing at managing analytical talent and the type of work they should be doing. So that group went from 600 people to 300 people, and they actually ended up doing more than they were doing before and with better outcomes. The third one, this one is my favorite, and it's about shifting work to high performers and really looking at your individual productivity. Or I guess said another way, it's about force ranking almost all your employees. But we find that when you have 20 or 30 people doing the same thing, there's consistently this massive delta between the highest and the lowest. And that delta is at least 3 times or as much as 10 times the productivity of that highest productive person versus the lowest. The last step after you do all that, so you have a smaller group by this point, you move to a more focused organizational structure. So often companies will start with org design at the beginning. We say, you know, find the right size of the group and then rebuild and do your org design there. And here we'd look at spans and layers. And the other key point here is moving your talent to the roles that are most valuable. So often you think, you know, that C-level or one under is the most valuable. Let's put our best players there. Actually, there can be pockets beneath that level, you know, the head of pricing or the head of procurement might not be C-level, but they're very critical roles and you put your best talent into those.
So is this essentially a way of improving employee productivity on a per person basis? And do you see it as a one-time process or is it something that's sort of a continuous journey?
What we've seen happen in most companies is, you know, every year there's a merit increase, call it 3 to 4%. And every year, every department hires a couple more people, so maybe 3, 3.5%. So you end up with about a 7% increase every year in payroll. And no one watches these metrics. They're totally unmanaged. So it happens every single year. And within 5 years of doing that, you're paying 50% more in wages. And in 10 years, you're twice the size. And it hasn't grown by thoughtful or conscious design. And so that's why we say when you manage these metrics carefully, you can actually grow by more thoughtful design. And maybe that requires doing a one-time reset.
Got it. So what's the best way to approach this reset, Radhika? Or how do private equity firms do it in your experience?
You know, we often get the question, you know, well, I want to offshore. I know that we're going to get so much benefits if we offshore or we outsource or, of course, automate something. Many large corporations pursue this type of process optimization in exactly the wrong order. And so we've seen what works the best, and in private equity we did this, is first you clean sheet the employee group. So then you reduce the total staff size and you have smaller, higher performing teams. Then you do the typical process redesign. So now you have a higher performing team. You can look at the steps in a process, remove what's unnecessary, simplify the process. Now that you have that high performing, standardized, documented process, then you automate those processes, right? Otherwise, you'd be automating a process that you don't even need, perhaps. After you do that, then you can evaluate the opportunity for geographic arbitrage. And then lastly, we'd say then consider outsourcing. Like, is there another party who might be the natural owner of the process? And again, what we often see is that it's done in exactly the wrong order. Many companies want to outsource first or offshore before they've done clean sheeting and really understood and redesigned the process. So what happens in the best case scenario, you're handing big dollar gains to the outsourcers. They're immediately going to go clean sheet, redesign, automate, take all that benefit instead of you. In the worst case scenario, what we've also seen happen is, you know, a messy process is outsourced and then errors go up, costs go up, and the customer satisfaction ultimately goes down. And you end up with a worse process, worse cost, and it's not owned by you, you know, the party that actually has leverage.
Thanks, Radhika. Are there certain functions or types of operations where standardizing performance and expectations this way works best, or where maybe it doesn't work as well? So, and how do you assess and track this?
So I think on, you know, common areas where we see the costs come down, usually it's the functions that are less directly supervised. So we, you know, call centers are one example. They're very closely supervised. It's pretty well documented how to monitor them. Often call centers will have individual productivity metrics and that's linked to software. So a little less opportunity often from those. But areas like IT, HR, material handlers, engineers, particularly engineers recently, we've seen those areas are always overstaffed. And it's because they're not tracking these individual productivity metrics. And that goes to your second question on, you know, how do you actually track this? Where's the data? I'd say, you know, to start with, this data is difficult to get. So it's almost impossible immediately to get 100% correct data. But what we found is even if it's 70% correct, 80% correct, maybe even a bit less, it's still indicative of the total opportunity. And one example is there's a company recently where we did this with developers. And so they didn't track how their individual developers were performing, but internally they had metrics that they did track. For example, how many story points or how much work did an employee do? And that type of metric, it's not perfect because it's not really measuring how good is the work they're doing. It's really measuring volume a little bit more.
So something I'd love to just add in here briefly is people may be listening and saying, hey, this sounds really cool. And they get it's all about productivity and cost savings. And it is. But I really want to stress this message that we have seen over many, many years, many companies and many functions that there's this amazing thing where your highest productivity employees are almost always the ones that are operating the most safely, producing the highest quality outputs, the highest customer sat and employee sat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's sort of a double whammy benefit here that by focusing on the employees that are most productive and ensuring and helping them get more productive, you automatically, in quotes, get gains in these other areas. And that's very, very important.
Interesting. Now, private equity is sometimes perceived as relying very heavily on layoffs. And when you roll out these productivity measures, specifically clean sheeting, as we've been discussing, how do you ensure that the high performers stay and stay motivated and that morale doesn't drop?
Yeah. So look, our experience in doing this, like practically at the rock face for years and years, is actually that the high performers have never heard anything better than this. They want this. They're sitting at home at night wondering why individual productivity isn't being managed and recognized. And they typically know they're contributing a lot and don't love the fact that, you know, managers aren't paying attention. The issue tends not to be the high performers. They tend to really get behind this and get excited about it. I'd say the challenges are more, you know, the folks in the middle, you know, getting people excited that high productivity is a better way for them to get engaged in their jobs, to make more money ultimately over time, and also to have the company be the most successful, which ultimately will lead to employment gains in the long run.
Yeah, and I'll add, you know, obviously incentives can be a big part of this and putting in that financial incentive, but non-monetary rewards and recognition we found also really work. So once you started tracking individual productivity, it's much easier to to put in place that type of recognition. And that goes a long way with employees, so, you know, both your high performers and your middle performers.
Thank you both. And now let's move on to the next insight from private equity, which seems to match a fairly well-known TV series title. John, do you want to take us through that?
So this is one of my favorite topics, which is what I call breaking bad revenue. So it begs the question, what is bad revenue? And what I'd like to sort of remind everyone, I think we all know this, but it's a good reminder, which is revenue growth is only good provided that it is cash accretive. And so breaking bad revenue is really about doing this kind of customer dissection and peeling and understanding where are we making and losing money. There's typically four dimensions against which we do these dissections. So the first is we look at customer profitability. Second, we'll look at geographic profitability, right? By country, by region, by city. Third, we will look at product and service dissection. So where are we making money by product, by service type, et cetera? And then lastly, what we call asset type dissection. You might have heard the terms OpCo, PropCo, DigitalCo. We recently looked at a retailer. The retailer wasn't really a retailer. It was really an operating company that had leases, a property company that owned real estate, and a digital company, right? And it had to be dissected that way with the full economics to truly understand it. And so the power of breaking bad revenue is peeling the onion inside your business along these four dimensions in a granular way to see where are we making high returns on capital, high free cash flow, and where are we losing returns on capital and free cash flow. And I will tell you that the answers are always surprising. They are always surprising.
And I'll add, you know, there was a private equity company owned company I went into, and you know, the CFO said, you know, we do this. We know our profitability by product. And when you dug into it, they were actually doing allocations based on revenue or customers. And what we did in private equity, we went in and actually looked at what was the time a customer service agent was spending on a particular product. So really important, not just to do allocations, but see, you know, is this product or customer so complicated that people are spending more time on it?
Sure. And are there any other examples that might bring this to life, John?
This is an example of a technology company that was struggling to move its aggregate free cash flow. And candidly, the management team was looking at what we would characterize as pretty small opportunities, things like, you know, making its sales force work a little bit better that was worth $5 million, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What we did is we went in and did what we would call a product profitability dissection to really look deeply at, by product, where was free cash flow being made and lost? And you see something quite fascinating here, which is very, very material cash losses in, you know, a significant number of products. What I will say is that this was partially understood by this technology company in sort of a, you know, a vague way. People had a feeling that some of the products weren't contributing. And certainly the materiality of it in toto was a surprise. You know, just a really good example of peeling the onion and understanding that, wow, we can move aggregate free cash a lot by shedding or fixing some of these product lines. We've seen this work across industries. So I'm going to say that again, right? You know, management teams just obsess and spend so much time, typically in public companies, how do we grow 2%, 3%, 3.5%? And yet it may, I stress, may be the case that actually shrinking by 3% or 5% could be the biggest EBITDA and free cash flow opportunity in the company. And properly communicated, I stress that, properly communicated and telegraphed to public markets, we have seen and believe profoundly that that is value creating.
Thank you. So this is great. Radhika, let's move on to the fourth insight, which is on building businesses.
Another thing we always did in private equity is we thought about how do we get real and new revenue growth in a few years. So not in 5 years, not in 10 years, but in 2 to 3 years, how do we scale that meaningfully? And, you know, in many industries, we're seeing now, especially investors often disproportionately reward revenue growth. And with disruptors in just about every single area, we always thought about how do we fend them off and how do we capture some of that benefit for ourselves? And so we would think about what are the possible businesses we could build? Is it, you know, for unserved or high potential customers? Is it new products? Is it new geographies? And then actually go and do it and do it fast the way a startup would. And so we would go through the how. How do we do this? You know, do we make it ourselves? Do we buy something? Do we have some tech assets or IP sitting there that we could use for this? But really fast, how do we come up with new ideas, test them out, and scale them in only 2 to 3 years? And that was, you know, in just about every company we owned when I was in private equity, we would think about doing this and launch it within 6 months.
So if I could just add here, it is absolutely vital that if you're going to do these business builds, you recognize that the perimeter of the business build has got to play by different rules. I think one of the biggest mistakes that Radhika and I see is that typically in a corporate, right, they will identify some IP or an interesting business and they want to scale it, but it operates by the same rules that the whole company operates by. Where in private equity, the thinking would be much more, how do we get a unique management team in there? How do we cordon them off in their own office? How do we get 3 or 4 people who've actually scaled startups like this before, right? So all in on the conditions for success that are going to make a difference. And so my one message is, I wouldn't do these business builds unless you're going to follow through with all of the conditions for success that typically investors, I think, are quite sophisticated at putting in place.
Now, you hear so many stories, you know, a large company bought a startup, they integrate it within their team, and then the startup founders leave. They don't like that type of environment and the product just fizzles out. So in private equity, we did the exact opposite of that, which is, you know, let them work on their own. They have a different skill set. They should operate by different rules. And that was the way we got them to scale fast.
Okay. So this is also a theme we've heard in discussions about corporate venture capital as well. What's the next insight?
It's about, you know, really peeling back the onion and looking at granular pockets. And so tearing apart averages to really look at where, what are the granular pockets of growth, or how do granular pockets of customers or products look? And so take a random market. And we've spent some time on the disaster restoration market. So let's look at that. On average, this market grows by 6%. Then if you go down, if you break it apart by the type of product, the type of restoration, you can actually say it goes from 0 to 10% growth. And then if you move it apart to by geography and you strip it apart that way, you can see the growth is minus 4% to plus 24%. And then you go even further, you break it down, you can see actually, you know, that 6% has now gone from minus 10% to plus 28%. And then you can look at each pocket of that and see, you know, how do we treat that differently? And this is how you move a company up in growth or margin, by you could focus on these little pockets. And every single group in here is a little bit different and they require different treatment. Or if you want to exit certain markets, this is the way that you do that analysis. So in private equity, we always peel back the onion, you know, at least 2, 3, even 4 layers back sometimes to really see where are the tiny pockets of growth or the tiny pockets that we need to do something very different.
Radhika, is this something where the strong financial planning and analysis foundation that we talked about earlier is really critical? And would that necessarily be the team doing this granular analysis that you just spoke about?
Yes, FP&A can look at this and they often do, particularly by region or by customer segment. And then I've also seen kind of your product group look at this, you know, by product, they need to see, you know, where do we need to add different features or shut down products. Marketing also looks at it because your customer segments are going to be much different when you peel back the onion. So actually almost every single group should be looking at this with the right level of granularity.
Thanks so much, Radhika. So this is not just an FP&A thing, and I appreciate you clarifying that. John, why don't you take us through the next one?
Okay. So firstly, let's talk about programmatic M&A. So McKinsey over the years has actually done a lot of research on this topic. And the fundamental takeaway is
that large transformational deals, very significant in market cap and value compared to the acquirer's base value, tend not to be the highest value creating, or incredibly small deals. What appears to lead to the highest returns over time from an M&A program is this sort of programmatic M&A, which is small to medium size assets that are plugged on to an acquirer on a fairly regular basis over time. And importantly, where the acquirer has built a real capability to identify interesting assets, to diligence them, to integrate them and operate them in a way that is distinctive, right? It's like anything in life. If you're doing one-offs, it's much more hard to be world-class or distinctive versus building an engine and through repetition and study and seriousness, becoming excellent at it. So that's what programmatic M&A is, and we think that's the right answer. I think in private equity, that again is used extensively, where even in an acquired business, the idea is always, how do we add on to this in sort of manageable chunks over time and deploy more capital, more follow-on capital? So what do they do that makes them distinctive? I think the first thing is a much wider notion of scanning for adjacencies. And I would say that technology, this is a place where we're really seeing technology being used a lot, and also scanning in non-traditional places. So not only public companies, that's table stakes. It's looking in the portfolios of private equity and venture capital firms. It's looking at startups that are owned by incubators and founders. And it's scanning in non-traditional geographies for those assets as well. So a really expansive and creative sense for identifying assets, point one. I think point two is this notion of a thesis. And I'll say tongue in cheek that one of my favorite questions to ask a head of corporate development is, what is your list of dream deals? And what's the thesis? What's the investment thesis for every dream deal? You might think that that's such an obvious question to ask a head of corporate development or even a CEO. In our experience, it's actually pretty rare to get a world-class answer to that question. And what world-class means is we have a list of 20 rotating assets. We're monitoring them every quarter against a series of acquisition guardrails, right? So when something falls in price or trips another indicator, we know we should be on it and looking at it carefully. That's pretty rare. And then the second thing that's rare is really, again, having that informed, rigorous, numbers-based financial thesis to say, listen, if we buy this for $1 billion, we see $2 billion in equity upside. So that, I think, is a little bit of the state or the frontier of programmatic M&A when it comes to private equity. And I really think there's a lot of good parallels and insights and learning for other types of companies there.
So it's both interesting and not really surprising that being able to more clearly articulate what your dream deals are make it much more likely that you'll act on them effectively. So let's move on to the last lesson.
Okay, so let me end on another favorite topic here, which is we call this CEO return on time. CEO return on time. And in a way, this is a bit of a capstone to everything we've been talking about, because one of the fun things of our job right now is we get to work with so many management teams. And it is the case in higher performing management teams that people are generally focused on a smaller set of priorities, that those priorities are laser aligned in the team. And as a result, execution is simpler and more effective. So, what's the role of a CEO? Like, what are the six major jobs of a CEO? And I'll just quickly walk through these. So the first we say is always managing yourself, thinking about your long-term goals, your own strengths and weaknesses, acting on your feedback from your board, et cetera. Often forgotten, but the first priority. Second, building and selling the vision and setting non-negotiable financial and non-financial targets. Job two. Job three, building a strategic plan, right? Kind of 5 to 7 things, 4 to 6 things to get between where the asset is today and where we want to get it, right? So that strategic plan is the third job, driving execution and monitoring that plan of the CEO. Fourth is monitoring current performance. How are we doing versus those set of targets that we've set up, right? That's the weekly, quarterly, monthly job of a CEO. Five is about leading internal. So that's managing the top team, managing high performers, managing all other staff, and maybe most importantly, setting a culture of high performance, right? Those are all the ways the CEO leads internally. And then finally, number six, leading externally. That's a large category of stakeholders. It can be buyers, suppliers, competitors, new entrants, certainly the board, perhaps the most important, quote, external stakeholder, formally and informally, and then, you know, often banks and other shareholders, right? So a quick way to think about the six things we say that only the CEO can do, right? Those are the major things that only a CEO can do. And the key takeaway is spending time in each of these buckets. Now, of course, the world is not simple. Every asset is different. Every context is different. So in practice, a CEO overweights, obviously, in any day, in any week, in any month. And whether you're early in tenure or late in tenure or before a transaction, obviously all that changes. But over the course of a year, at least for these sponsors, there was this view that a CEO's time should cover all these essential buckets. If you survey CEOs, which we have done, and ask them where do they spend their time over the course of a year against those six buckets, their perception is they over-index internally and externally. And CEOs often tell us things like, I spend very little time managing myself. I have no alone time. I don't spend enough time on the vision. I don't spend enough time monitoring performance, et cetera, right? Very common feedback that we get from CEOs and working with them very intensely. But if you actually go and rip down the calendars, and this is fun to do and very possible to do, if you know, take a CEO's Outlook calendar, you can rip it down and categorize all of the meetings. And we have done this many, many, many times. You actually see the CEO is spending huge portions of time internally. And so the takeaway here is that, you know, a couple of things. One is CEOs generally don't know where they're spending their time. They're not being planful about it when actually it's their single most important resource. No more valuable resource than a CEO's time. And also, second big takeaway, that some of these absolutely vital functions are not getting invested in the way that they deserve.
That's really interesting. But how does a CEO practically make this happen? How do they make sure that they're actually spending sufficient time across these priority areas that you just described?
The key, right? It's almost like it's like a thermostat in your house. You have to measure the temperature and then you can manage it. So the first thing is you've got to start actually understanding and measuring and managing, where do I spend my time? Not where I want to. Where do I spend my time? And the key there, this is why an executive assistant is such a strategic asset, a total strategic asset to any executive. You need to forge a relationship with that person where they are categorizing your time. I would offer our buckets as one way to do that. I'm sure people could improve on it. And track on a weekly, monthly, quarterly basis, where are people spending their time? And then give that as a report. It's a great way to meet with your EA monthly, and he or she can read out to you, where are you spending your time? And then the second key to improve it, obviously, is be planful about the buckets. What does a perfect week look like? Like, what would it look like if we controlled our calendar instead of our calendar controlling us? Every week, I should have buckets where I'm leading internally, but not being sucked into a million meetings. Every week I should have a meeting, which is a strategic pillar meeting. We go over the various pillars of our strategic plan. So the point is, design your perfect week and have your EA report back on variances between actual and perfect week. That's the key to cracking this.
The perfect week. That would be lovely. Now, the context for a public company CEO is often quite different than that for a CEO of a PE-owned portfolio company. Can you just take us through some of the different barriers and enablers that a public company CEO might encounter, and how can they pursue the insights that you shared today?
Okay. I want to say we don't offer any of the suggestions we have naively. We understand that often this is challenging. So listen, I'm going to start in my view with sometimes the biggest barrier to doing a lot of the things that we're talking about is unambitious targets. People might laugh when they hear me say that, but you know, the greatest enemy to better performance is having a weak or not ambitious target, because it kills any discussion about anything we're talking about. If you're already hitting plan, or we can hit plan by doing very incremental, non-exciting, non-ambitious things, then all of this is going to be moot and no one is going to entertain a conversation about this. So in a way, the dialogue has got to start by how does the board and the CEO in particular, but also the top team, have an honest, serious, real conversation about, are our targets bold? Are we trying to be among the best in our industry or the best in the world? I recognize that's a hard conversation to have often, but it has to start there, because only with ambitious targets will the kind of tools and techniques and ideas that we're sharing with you really, I think, come to the surface.
It's so easy to fall in the trap of looking backwards, but we found past performance has just about no relationship with what is actually possible. And so that rear view mirror is a constraint. And you know, often private equity will come in and do something vastly different and accomplish results that, you know, prior management thought was completely impossible. So I'd remember that past performance is not a limit on future potential.
Great point also, Radhika. Thank you. John, Radhika, this has been a fantastic conversation. Really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. We'd welcome your feedback and your ideas for future podcasts. All you need to do is email us at itsr@mckinsey.com. That stands for Inside the Strategy Room. And if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to subscribe, you can follow our weekly series on any podcast player. And you can also access our entire library of previous episodes. We also offer an Inside the Strategy Room podcast collection page at mckinsey.com/ITSR. And there you can easily browse our prior podcasts across six major themes, as well as access written transcripts of all of those conversations. Finally, if you'd like to automatically receive our latest publications and insights, we encourage you to sign up for email alerts on our insights page at mckinsey.com and connect with us on LinkedIn at the McKinsey Strategy and Corporate Finance Practice page. Thanks again for listening. We look forward to having you join us again next week inside the Strategy Room.